Secretary come to order. Today is April 15th at 1 p.m. The first item we're going to do is open a public hearing on House Bill 3343.
Do you have the SMS on that? Thanks. House Bill 3343, basically the amendment deletes the bill and changes the penalties for employees of off-premises sales licensees. We do not yet have a fiscal impact statement on this bill.
Steve Konopah, Rod Brown,
and Tom Irvin, please. Please go ahead and just identify yourself by name for the record.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, representatives, members of the committee, I'm Steve Konopah. I work for the United Food and Commercial Workers. I'm the staff director there. We're based out of Tigard, and we represent grocery workers in the state of Oregon.
Tom Irwin, I'm the government affairs director with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission.
Rod Brown. Currently a checker at Kaiser Safeway.
Okay. Chair Barker, members of the House Judiciary Committee, I've already introduced myself. Our organization represents 90,000 members in Oregon and Southwest Washington, and I come before you today in support of House Bill 3343 and strongly encourage you to support and help pass this bill. It's vital to our workers who work in the grocery industry as checkers in Oregon. House Bill 3343 would allow for a civil rather than a criminal penalty when there is an inadvertent sale of alcohol to a minor, only in cases, though, where a clerk has had an OLCC-approved training program. Currently, the law is that anyone appearing to be, and this is a typo in my written testimony, and I apologize, but I was excited to get the testimony to you, so I used our industry-wide standard of 28 years old, but it's state law is 26. A lot of our grocery union stores that we partner up with, they actually require 28 or 30 or even higher company policy to card individuals, so I apologize for that error. But it's very difficult to decipher if somebody's 26 or 25 and a half or whatever. When those isolated mistakes do happen, the checker is always fired, and they have a criminal infraction on their permanent record. It is nearly impossible for them to be reemployed at another location in our jurisdiction. UFCW has worked and will continue to work with the OLCC to provide our members with a proper training in alcohol sales. This type of approved training is not available in all stores as a rule, yet many of our members have taken it upon themselves to complete the program, and often at their own expense. House Bill 3343 takes this responsible approach into account and provides for a reduced penalty if the clerk has completed the training. And we got to be clear here, we're not condoning, in no way, selling alcohol to minors. That's not our role here. We believe in proper training, and we take this as a social responsibility. It's very serious. It's a very serious issue. But I am pointing out that in our business, our checker can service thousands of people a year in the busy stores, and over a period of years, that's even more than that. And when that happens, a Class A violation with a substantial fine would be a much more appropriate remedy than the loss of a current and all future jobs in the industry, and for it to be a criminal violation. In closing, I would just like to thank Tom Irwin and all the people at OLCC who have helped us at UFCW on this particular issue for years, other unions as well, and Dina Ryerson of the Department of Justice for working with us on the proper language and the class of violation. That's my testimony, and I thank you for your time. If you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to respond.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Chair Barker and members of the House Judiciary Committee. My name is Rodney Brown, and I work at the Safeway Kaiser. I am a union member with UFCW Local 555. I have worked in this location for over 7 years, and I can tell you that it's a very difficult industry to work in. Every day we are faced with the pressure of keeping the lines moving and keeping the customers serviced properly. I take my job seriously. At my age, I cannot afford to lose my job, or is much worse to have a criminal infraction. Our members work in many different companies, and there is not a mandated training for alcohol sales for our members. If we take upon ourselves to go through the OLCC training on our own time and expense, it should show how committed we are in obeying the law. I am not trained in how to recognize a fake ID. It is difficult indeed to determine a person's age while playing beat the clock by trying to keep the lines moving. Without proper training, an honest mistake can be made. House Bill 3343 would let those clerks that go through the training and then who accidentally sell to a minor receive a Class A violation instead of a misdemeanor. Most of us are part-time workers. A fine of $250 to $500 is a serious blow to our families. We want to be responsible to our communities and to our companies, and we're willing to go through the training and be able to do the jobs better. In closing, I appeal to your compassion and understanding that if a person receives a proper training and in good faith and still has the isolated mistake or mishap towards selling alcohol to a customer, that you think about the future of that checker from a job standpoint and a permanent record standpoint. The penalty should be reduced to a violation and a fine, and believe me, that is plenty for a checker to deal with to make sure it never happens again. Checkers do not intentionally try to violate anything, whether it be company policy or state or federal law. We all wish to keep our jobs and only want to properly be properly trained and to be treated the same way that restaurant servers are. Please support and help pass House Bill 3343. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Tom Irwin. I'm the Government Affairs Director with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And the commission does support the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3343. I don't know that they've been offered formally yet, but I believe everybody should have a copy. We believe this is a good solution for what currently exists in the law today, with the having a criminal record and prohibiting people from seeking employment elsewhere should they unfortunately and mistakenly perhaps sell to a minor. In many instances, it prevents them from getting employment elsewhere at another employer should they be let go. So this particular approach puts them in the same category as we currently have for service permittees in the restaurant association and the restaurant world, if you will. So this would kind of have a parallel path in the grocery area, the convenience store area, and the clerk area. A number of grocers, that may be testimony that's following us here, already have programs that are either have been approved or can be approved pretty quickly and easily. We think this is a good solution. There's a number of independent operators out there that offer the kinds of classes or programs that would qualify for clerks to go through as well.
Okay, thank you. Any questions,
Mr. Chair, maybe a comment. I appreciate that this is coming forward because I've seen a lot of times when these people, they're not criminals. That's not a criminal act. That's not an intentional thing to harm. But you have three members of this committee or past police officers who dealt with people of different ages, 16, 18, are they 21? And when I was younger, it seemed like I could tell. When I got older, they all looked young. I couldn't tell one from the other. Now, most people don't think I'm 85. And they don't think Barker's 40. I mean, so it is hard to tell. And, you know, thank God that we kid Representative Martin. We all are jealous that we don't look that young. It's jealousy.
I don't think you look a bit over 80.
Are you 85, Representative?
Not quite. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Tom, thanks for your testimony. I heard a couple comments that we want to be treated just like a restaurant server is. Restaurants servers are mandated to take OLCC training, correct? So there's a little bit difference there.
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, that is correct. There is a requirement to be a service permit if you're serving alcohol in those particular kinds of establishments. That's the way the law is written today.
The follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Please.
If a checker had an OLCC server's permit from a restaurant, would that suffice under this statute to protect them?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, yes, I believe the amendment addresses that, and I'm hopeful it does. Section 1, on page 2, section 1, sub 6, I think it says, line 17, or to an employee of a person licensed or appointed under this chapter, if the employee holds a valid service permit. So my understanding is that is what is intended, is that somebody that already has a valid service permit would also qualify.
Okay, just...
If that was your question.
Yeah, just to clarify. So we're not creating another permit here. In other words, today I could go online and take that server's permit online. It's available.
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, absolutely. That would be one way you could do it. Also, you could do it through an approved program that a store already has in place that we've given authorization for. It's a type of training program that would be very similar to a service permit class.
Okay. One more question. The fees involved, how do they compare?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, should they go to take a service permit class and go and get a permit, there is a fee involved. Should they be an employee of a current store, presumably that training would be provided, and if it was an approved or authorized training, that would be provided as a part of employment. So there would be a distinction in terms of the cost.
Then, if I may, who's going to issue the card? Will OLCC issue a card? And is there a fiscal or a fee to that?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, if they have a service permit, they certainly will have a card.
Correct.
If they are in a establishment that has an authorized training program, then certainly they're going to have a record about who is qualified, who has taken that training. I'm not sure that we, and hold on just a second, have looked at all the particulars about that. I'm getting a shaking of the head, no. So presumably that would be something that they would have to keep on record. We could probably do that by rulemaking rather than having to go through statute or anything else if need be.
Just last thing, if I may. I think that's important that if we are comparing this to a program that servers in a restaurant are having to take that is mandatory, and we're going to have a volunteer program to provide the same protection, that there's the same level of accountability towards those cards being issued, and as a server, whether I'm a checker or a server, I have that card and it's issued and controlled by the OLCC, which might mean there's a little bit of a fee to this. Just something that I like to bring up.
And Chairman Barker, Representative Cameron, members of the committee, I think the issue here is, you know, doing this on a mandatory basis, we probably wouldn't have come to agreement with everybody in terms of having anything here before you today. I don't think the industry was going to be in favor of that. I think I can't speak for the union, but I'm certain when there's cost involved, as you well know, everybody gets nervous. I think what we're trying to drive the train forward to in this process is to get the education that will help people become aware of what their obligations and responsibilities are in this process. Maybe they should have been already, who knows, but I'm suggesting that if we think training is meaningful and beneficial, which I think it is, then this is a helpful process to get us on the road, even though it's voluntary in some respects.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Representative Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, maybe a question for you or Tom, but I'm going to kind of spin off the letter that you provided to us, Steve. And basically, you talk about the proper training hours. Who pays for that? I mean, is it the organization pays for that or the individual?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, members of the committee. Right now, in the employers, I think they may be here, too. They can respond to it, too, and Tom probably will want to do a follow-up. Currently, I believe if the employee themselves pay for support if they're going to do the actual off-site OLCC training. A lot of our employers, they all provide some training program, some format. I just don't believe they're all using the OLCC training program. They provide free training for their employees if it's their program. If it's OLCC, I'm really not sure at this point.
Follow up then.
Please, go ahead.
So, Tom, do you have an idea then what the cost is going to be for the training that's provided?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, let me see if I can ask Linda if she might. Well, actually, we have people here that can. I can't answer. I apologize.
Okay.
We do have
people. We have two more people coming.
Just one more question,
sure,
Mr. Chair.
Please.
How often will the training be provided then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, are you talking about what's available out there exclusive of the establishments, the grocery stores themselves, in terms of the providers that are out there? Oh, our agency, we're not the only one that offers this. I should probably indicate to you that there are other providers that are private providers out there that can offer this for people as well. There's almost, I don't know how many there are today. About a year ago when I was looking at this, there was about 30 providers. It may have been reduced because it's also available online now through the Oregon Restaurant Association if you wanted to get a service permit at 24/7, 365 days a year. Presumably. So if somebody wanted to do it that way, there is a cost involved. I apologize. I don't know it off the top of my head, but it's, I believe it's less than $25 or in that ballpark.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm a little bit confused here then. I can go online, go through this training, and all of a sudden learn how to recognize a 26-year-old and a 20-year-old.
Is that a question?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, presumably the training includes things to help you identify the identification. There are so many false IDs out there. That's one of the things that they go through. Certainly, I would hope, I haven't been through the training myself, so I can't speak to it from that standpoint, but presumably they're also asking folks to be cognizant of people's age when they're looking at people's IDs. That is part of the training, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I appreciated the conversation I had today. This is the first time I'm seeing these amendments. A couple of questions. When I first thought about this, I was thinking that the training would happen after the violation. I now, as I understand it, it happens beforehand so I can get my little badge, my sort of get-out-of-jail-free card in advance of doing something wrong. So I think I got that right. My second question, but I want to make sure, my second question is I'm sure it's here that I've just missed, but subsequent violations. If I'm somebody who I went through the class, I got my get-out-of-jail-free card, and I keep doing it, right? At some point, and all I see here is the fines, and I didn't parse it probably carefully enough. But at some point, does it stop being just a violation and move back to being a crime, or how do we deal with somebody who does it? Because it says sort of second and subsequent. You know, it doesn't say it upon third. You know, it's a crime.
I would like to respond, Chair Barker, Representative Smith, members of the committee. I guess from our union standpoint, because we're going to do everything in our power to make sure that our union members at store level don't violate the law.
Sure.
We have only had one case in my knowledge in my 10 years on staff where we've been able to get somebody back to work because of their first violation.
Yeah,
they're normally terminated, so I guess...
So maybe it doesn't matter, but I'm still curious.
It's a good point you raise, but I guess from our point of view, we want to make sure it's preventative maintenance, that it never happens. If it does happen, maybe it's just a one-time occurrence. That would be my response.
But am I right in my reading that it stays a Class A violation and doesn't move to misdemeanor on subsequent offenses regardless?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I believe that is correct, yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Next,
we'll call Mary Bonkin and Sean Miller.
This is Wayne Miller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75, and we represent the folks who issue the citations at OLCC. And I'm going to be actually very brief today because I think that Sean and perhaps others are going to be better to talk about the technicalities of how this will work. I just want to say that this will be the third session we have brought either that this bill has been before the legislature in one form or another, and I think we finally got it right. And this is really about holding people accountable who purposefully break the law. Now, I just talked with one of our OLCC folks, and she said there's only been two or three cases where they've identified somebody who's sort of doing this on purpose, and there's only been one or two cases where they've had a second violation. So this really is important that we give people the opportunity to get trained, do the right thing, have the skills needed that they need in lines when you're standing there at a checkout line, and to give that person who makes an honest mistake a second chance and not losing their career. And that's really all this bill is about. And with that, I will close and turn it over to Sean.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association in support of House Bill 3343 and the Daddy's One Amendment. I'd like to just comment on some of the questions that have been asked, Mr. Chairman. I think I'll start with Representative Cameron on distinguishing the difference between the server permit that restaurants use versus how this program will work. And he is correct that they receive a card. And under this particular program, and I'll use the example of Safeway, since the UFCW member was an employee of Safeway, how we envision this working is Safeway would have an approved program by OLCC, and this would be in their training. So a new employee would come over from UFCW, it would go through the company training program. This would be incorporated into that program, so the issue of the costs, I think Representative Olson brought up, is just part of our way of training an employee. And they would receive in their employee records basically that they were approved and went through this server program through Safeway and in their employment records. And so as for a card issued by OLCC, even though it will be the same program that restaurants go through, I think to avoid a fiscal impact and make sure that this works, the employer is going to have the records that they've actually gone through that. And so a little bit different than the card, but the same program, the same intent of the program that the restaurants use. And so I think that's how we envision this particular program working. And I can see Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron has a question.
Representative Cameron.
It's good for Safeway. What about the Nighty Night store on the corner that's a one-time operator? How do we deal with him and his clerks, her clerks?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, again, there is going to be options to where that employee would, and again, this is a choice. They could choose to go online or go through even the Oregon Restaurant Association to get their server permit, which, you know, would have a cost to it. But to get that, then they choose to not be under this particular standard being a violation. And so if they do not do that, then if I'm not correct, they would be under this current law where there would be a class A misdemeanor versus a violation. And I think to sum this up, Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Smith asked a question on subsequent, and we feel that that will probably never happen. I think what this bill is trying to get at is the first time, the example is the 20-year-old who, let's say, makes a mistake, and they lose their job. And under that, they lose their job and they have a violation. Class A misdemeanor on their record. So you're taking a 20-year-old who may not be able to get a job because not only did they get fired, but they have a record. So how do you balance an honest mistake versus at least allowing that person to continue to work? And so we don't believe those subsequents will actually occur, because I know that we take that training very seriously, and it just rarely happens, and I've never heard that occurring.
Hey, Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and I hear, and it was in the testimony just previous was very helpful in thinking, well, yeah, they lose their jobs, they're not going to do it again. And probably the turnover in a lot of these jobs is high enough that the odds that they're going to be there for years and years so that they could have the opportunity to do it a bunch of times. But I do wonder about the stores. It does occur to me that a store, bartender, whatever, you know, whatever, wherever this applies, might be in business long enough to do this more than once, twice, or three times. And I'm cognizant of sort of our timeline on this and that any further amendments might be challenging to do. But maybe it wouldn't be impossible to do on the Senate side if we move it out of this. And so if we're doing sort of previous training, but if it happens on a particular location twice, maybe the training didn't take, maybe they're not doing it well enough, maybe the online thing didn't work quite as well as we'd hoped. And so maybe you have to do the training again after the second time. Maybe the third time it's a crime, right? And I'm not, I mean, that may be something to consider. And if it never happens, well, the only cost it took us was writing up something to get us to pass a slightly different bill. But maybe I'm way off base, and if I'm crazy, please let me know so. Because I think what you said, the objective of try not to nail people for no good reason, is a very sensible objective.
Mr. Chair, OLCC just passed me a note, and I want to just, for the record, let you all know that OLCC does offer free classes once a month in Portland and as needed elsewhere in the state. And I think, Mr. Chair, the other impartial answer to Representative Smith's issue, one of the things that the person who's selling liquor to underage individuals needs to remember is that we do have liquor liability issues. So the 24-hour convenience store that just absolutely refuses to sort of get in line, they really do face some pretty hefty penalties through liquor liability on top of, you know, what the clerk faces. So I think, you know, we need to remember that this sort of all meshes together in liquor laws and responsibilities.
Okay. I think we're heading in the right direction. I think an amendment, however, that would determine how establishments keep records would be helpful on this, so that somebody, you know, of course, says, yeah, I'm trained, and maybe they're not, so that everybody knows, and so we can protect everybody, including the minors who are trying to buy it, keep them from getting it, would be helpful. So I don't think it's too late. It's getting close to line, but it would be helpful if everybody could get together one more time, take another peek at that, and see if we work with the Council Shannon here and see if we can do that. And you might take a look at multiple times, although, like you say, the liquor license could be pulled from the establishment. The store could lose their right to sell liquor. But we might just take a look at that, because somebody without a license, it's a crime. Somebody with a license, it isn't. I mean, that's a pretty broad disparity, so we might just take a look at that. Without the training, I'm sorry, not a license. Somebody without the training, it's a misdemeanor. Somebody with the training, it isn't. So we just might want to take a quick look at those things and come back, and we'll not move any further today on this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3343. And we'll move to a work session on House Bill 2727.
House Bill 2727, first heard on March 10th, prevents the release of information identifying the holder or applicant for a concealed handgun license and authorizes the disclosure pursuant to court orders or criminal justice purposes. However, the Dashiell Amendment places this exemption into the public record statute, ORS 192.502, and provides that it may only be released upon a showing of clear and convincing evidence that the public interest requires disclosure. It allows the holder to request notification from the sheriff if there is a records request for the holder's permit, and requires the custodian of records to consider any information the holder provides prior to making a decision to release the holder's information. We've received you have the dash 8s before you. We have received the fiscal impact, and it is a minimal expenditure impact, so there's no statement issued. And I believe that the chair is going to consider suspending the rules because we do not yet have the no revenue dash 8 statements before us.
Okay, and the only, we usually don't have any testimony in a work session. I'm going to ask Mr. Powell to come forward, since the sheriff's brought this bill to us, and ask for protection against anybody getting into those records. If you just let us know how the sheriff's okay with the dash 8s, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Powell, representing the sheriffs of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee,
we thought the bill we brought to you was a good bill. We are very much aware of the pushback and pain and agony that this bill has caused many of you as individuals and as a committee as a whole. And we do support the Dash 8 amendments because we think it will get clear through the process for sure. We have our doubts about the original bill. So we would be full support of the Dash 8 amendments. And Sheriff Gordon, who was here when you had the original hearing, is in support of these amendments.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Powell. And I want to thank the committee for all the work that's been done by so many people on this bill, getting it straightened out. It's simple. What started out to appear to be a simple bill, as usual, didn't turn out to be quite so simple. And we are up to the Dash 8 amendments. We've amended it 8 times, and it was even one further. And it was a very bipartisan effort. I want to give due credit to everybody who worked on that.
Sure. All of us that worked on that amendment and the other amendments, I appreciate the work that went into it. And then also Representative Steigler, we've had conversations, I think, 2 or 3 times the last couple days. And if there are unforeseen consequences that we didn't cover, didn't understand at the time, that can, in fact, be fixed in the next session or 2 sessions or 3 sessions. And if you think back about the number of bills we've already seen on the floor that are fix-it bills for things that we've done, that's kind of what this process causes to happen. And I had her commitment to work with us if we do find something, and I'm sure we'll be able to do that.
Okay, thank you. And I want to point out that the standard of clear and convincing evidence that the public interest outweighs the privacy of the individual is a very high legal standard. It is just one notch below beyond a reasonable doubt. So that there are some people didn't seem to understand that and thought that was really make it easy to get into it. That the custodian of the record has to be presented with that evidence and then notify the concealed handgun permit holder, who still has a chance then to argue for additional protection. They also put additional protections in the Dash 8. Representative Westand, did you have
no way to do okay. Introduction Dash 8.
Okay.
The Dash 8s? Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the Dash 8s are, as the Chair and Representative Krieger have indicated, are the result of a lot of time, effort, and energy by several people on this, and I appreciate the support in getting to this point. I believe what it does is, first of all, it provides the ultimate protection that we have currently under our public records laws. It is a fairly stringent standard in order to obtain the release of these records. And then secondly, one of the things that we did put into this version is the notification that must occur or must appear in the application, so that it's the applicant who has the burden of saying, yes, I want, if somebody comes to ask for the release of these records, I want to have some input. But it gives that notice that these are public records. There could be a request to release them, and then gives an opportunity for them to have some input upon that issue. So I think we've built about as many protections as we possibly can in the public records laws regarding this particular type of public record. And again, I just want to say I appreciate all the energy that went into trying to get to this point. And it was a bipartisan effort. I've had the and I would like to move the Dash 8s.
Representative Stigler moves the Dash 8s into House Bill 2727. Representative Wisnan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll be try to be brief, but I do have a lot of questions that are comments that I'd like to put on the public record. And it's been said, every member of this committee almost was a sponsor of the original bill. And for the young people that are sitting here in the audience, they talk about what comes out. Sometimes it's sausage. You don't want to see what went into it. Most of the members of this committee that were sponsored the original bill, but it's not possible to make that kind of that sausage, and you have to change what goes in the sausage, and that's what we have today. There's members of the committee that would like to have not gone here. There's stakeholders that did not want to go here. I think the chair has provided a lot of flexibility to the members to try to reach a solution and try to protect this sensitive information the best possible. Because I think the public needs to know that there's a lot more information that goes into a CHL than your name and address and phone number. There's a lot of other information in the application. And so that was what a lot of concern was about here. I'd like to read, Mr. Chair, of your approval, some statements that maybe we hope the Senate may question or look at to make this even better, and echo and endorse Representative Krieger's comments that we stand prepared to try to make it better if it doesn't work. So this is some questions that came up in our discussions and some concerns, and I will be supporting the Dash 8. We're concerned about some words in there about record and whether if someone came in and asked for a list, not an individual, but a list of all a profession or something like that, how is that going to be handled? We think this is going to protect it. We're concerned about the term custodian. We discussed that. Whether that is DHS or that's a law enforcement agency, it's our intent is it to be a law enforcement, a sheriff's office that is a custodian of that record. We talked about whether the sheriff would give the holder of the permit a chance to rebuttal the release to the public and how we would do that and how you get feedback to the person that requested that. I talked about how there's a lot more personal information in the application than address and phone number. And whether the sheriff, when he releases that information, if he thinks it's clear and convincing evidence and in the public interest, whether he can redact the information before releasing it to the public. I think I've covered everything. And again, Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing me to read this into the record. And I'll be providing this. I'll work in providing these questions to the Senate so they can be sure they understand it with legislative counsel too. And I stand prepared to support Dash 8.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and one who is not involved with all the details, but want to make sure that our constituents that have a CHL. And I guess I want to make sure that it's real easy to understand. What does the CHL holder have to do to make sure that his or her personal information, and I'm asking for including name and address and phone number, because some of these people that have these things for some reasons are trying to protect themselves from some really bad people. So I want to know what that CHL person has to do in plain English, basically, to not have their information removed. What would they have to do?
The custodian of the records is the sheriff, and somebody comes in and says, I need to see that, and the sheriff would ask them why. They'd have to present this high level of proof that they need it, and outweighs the public interest, outweighs the privacy. And then the sheriff, if you checked on your form, the sheriff would then notify you, somebody's trying to get your records, and here's what they presented, and you'd have a chance to rebut it. Please go ahead.
Follow up, if I may. So I applied, and I think I have to renew every 4 years. I'm not
4 years.
Sure,
right.
When my renewal comes up, because I never applied for one. So 3 years ago, I applied for one, and I didn't check a box about having my information withheld. How tomorrow somebody requests that, how does the sheriff handle my particular situation that I don't want because I've got an ex-wife who's going to come and find me?
The sheriffs came to us and said, we need this bill because people are knocking at the door that we don't feel we should give it out. It was the sheriff's custodians of those records who are very protective. With this bill passed, it's very clear the intent, if the bill passes both houses, it comes out of the legislature, it'll be very clear that the intent of this bill is to provide privacy to the concealed handgun license person. And that's what we want. And if we find anything going awry of that, we will come back and correct that in future sessions. I don't believe we're going to have to, because I believe this fits in just with what the sheriffs were asking for.
Just one last. So I will be contacted that somebody's trying to get my information,
I believe,
whether I've checked a box or not checked a box.
Well, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if I might. Representative Cameron, under, you know, because there are existing licenses out there, obviously, the sheriff would have the ability to contact those people and get their input, because it's clear the intent from the statute is that they have a right to have input. What this does is protect going forward. So there is nothing to prevent the sheriff, as most of them or many of them do now in those circumstances, contacting the applicant and indicating that there is a request for release of that information. Beyond that, from this point forward, it'll be the obligation of the applicant to make that known, whether they want that. But what I think people need to understand is clear and convincing is next to conviction for a crime is probably the most stringent burden of proof that our law applies. There is only one other place in the public records exemption statutes that sets forth a specific burden of proof. So this is the second one. And in my discussions with both sheriffs and people who have to apply public records laws and make a determination as to whether an exemption applies, my guess is it will be a very rare situation where that occurs. The burden of proof is so high on the part of the person making the request for the release of the records. So there is that potential gap in there. My guess is, again, in talking with a small cadre of sheriffs that I'm familiar with, the routine would be probably that they would contact the holder anyway.
Mr. Chair, and the last thing I'll say is just that I understand that, and I heard the word the sheriffs may, as they do today, but it's not the sheriff shall. If I have a concealed permit today, and I'm trying to protect that information, I need reassurance that I'm going to be protected or have the opportunity to protect that information. That'd be my only comment. So.
Thank you. Representative
Mr. Chair, thanks for your understanding here. I forgot one important discussion point that we had yesterday with Representative the Sheriff's Association, that the forms are not standard in the counties, and they pledged, and we will give them a letter asking them to please standardize. They're elected officials. We can't direct them, but we'll ask them to please standardize the forms and also address this notification in those forms.
Mr. Chair, if I might on
yes.
that. This is now in statute as part of what the application has to have in it, so they won't have any choice. I don't care how the rest of the application looks. This will be one of the required. This will be one of the required, list of things that has to be in that application.
Okay, thank you. And I want to thank everybody for their comments and making clear the intent coming out of this committee, what our intent is in protecting the citizens, the law-abiding citizens of Oregon who have these permits. Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be a no on the dash 8, so it doesn't mean I won't support the bill.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
No.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Schneider?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnitz?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
That's a dash 8. That was a dash 8.
Motion carries. Do we adopt the dash 8? That's the bill.
No, that was
the
dash
8. It says dash 8. Dash 8. So now I'm
okay.
We'll move the bill.
Yes.
What? You discussing who you would have carry in?
No, that was just a dash 8. Okay. So, Mr. Chair,
no, we don't have to. We did get the revenue.
Oh, okay.
It showed up mere moments ago.
Okay. So we don't. I was going to ask that. I was going
to. Perfect.
So, Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2727 as amended.
Everybody is to the floor with House Bill 2727 as amended to the floor
to pass.
Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnitz?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Representative Stigler, would you carry? And I appreciate the support of other people.
I would.
If you have comments when it gets to the floor, please get them out there for the record.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay.
What's next here? Open a public hearing on House Bill 2502.
House Bill 2502, the dash two amendments before the committee deletes the original bill and authorizes seizure or production of documents in accordance with a subpoena or warrant from a recipient outside of Oregon, regardless of the location where the recipient receives the service or where the records are physically located. We have received, I spoke too soon. I believe we're going to be receiving a minimal to no impact on the dash twos momentarily. Minimal.
Michael Slosson, Diana Vitlands, Vitlands, I believe.
Diana Vitlands.
And Gail Meyer. Please go ahead and identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slosson from the Oregon Department of Justice.
2502.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Diana Vitlands. I'm the Crook County District Attorney and here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association.
Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, my name is Michael Slosson from the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm in the Criminal Justice Division. I'm a Senior Assistant Attorney General. I'm here to testify in support of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2502. Specifically, I'll be talking about sections 1 through 3 that deal with the issue of criminal process. Originally, this bill dealt specifically with search warrants, and what it did was allow for the service of search warrants to be served in the manner provided under civil law for the service of a summons. We've met with our partners in the criminal law and decided that we'd go in a different direction. Rather than sort of go our own way with it, we would follow the lead of Washington State. And so the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2502, as they relate to those sections 1 through 3, and as they relate to criminal process, are derived from a Washington law that passed unanimously last year. As the Washington legislature recognized last year in its legislative findings, many businesses providing goods and services to the public now operate nationally and globally. The Washington legislature noted that the result is that many businesses engaging in business in Washington maintain business records elsewhere. They maintain them out of Washington State. Of course, that's the same in Oregon. A lot of the businesses doing business in Oregon maintain their records elsewhere. As the Washington legislature recognized, the ability of the criminal justice system to effectively perform depends upon law enforcement agencies, prosecutors, and criminal defense attorneys from being able to maintain and use records relevant to crimes that occur within the state, even when the records are not located in this state. I'm kind of reading here because these are direct out of the legislative findings from the Washington State Legislature. And what 2502 does is the same thing that the Washington legislation did, which is to sort of recognize a disconnect between our criminal laws that currently exist, our criminal procedure laws, and the world as we now know, which is global, and tries to address that disconnect. And so I want to talk about the three major changes, I guess, that I would say that 2502 makes to the current Oregon law. It will allow for the service of criminal process, which includes subpoenas, court orders, and search warrants on a business for its business records, regardless of whether the business records are actually located within the state. So you could have a business in Washington that's doing business and directing itself to Oregon customers. That business, even though it's located in Washington, could be subject to Oregon's jurisdiction. And there are constitutional limits, there are federal constitutional limits on when you can do that. And this bill would fall within those limitations because it would require that the business is conducting, would require that the business conduct business in Oregon and that the process relate to that. So it falls within those limitations. There's also a couple other protections for businesses. Businesses that are subject to this process can move to quash, and they're entitled to have a hearing on whether or not they're subject to jurisdiction, whether or not the process is overburdensome, however, whatever basis they want to move to quash. The other thing it does is it provides for civil and criminal liability protection for businesses to comply with process under 2502. The other thing 2502 does is expands the method of service. So when you're talking about subpoenas, in 2007, the legislature amended the subpoena statute to address the same sort of issue with subpoenas when you got records out of the state. It allowed for service by in person, which is what we always have historically done, but also provided for service by mail in limited circumstances on corporation and limited partnerships. What this would do is, again, allow for the mail, but it also allow for service by fax and service by electronic transmission, provided that the methods of services on these businesses allows for proof of service. So when you actually get in a situation, you can prove that the service was made. It does something different for warrants, too. Historically, and in our statutes in most states, warrants have to be served by a police officer. And most of the time, that's not a problem, because you're searching the defendant's property, and it's not a big deal. You want an officer there. Oregon has made an exception for bank records because when police want bank records and they have a search warrant, it doesn't make a lot of sense for the officer to kind of go stopping the bank's business and rummaging through the records of the bank. It makes more sense for the bank employees to do that. So Oregon actually has a law that says if you're doing a search warrant for bank records on a financial institution, you actually have to serve it like a subpoena. You don't have a choice. It must be served like a subpoena. And so that actually comes up with a lot of other businesses, most businesses that that they're not actually a subject of the criminal investigation. Let me give you an example where it can really come up when you got a business out of state. Say, for instance, you've got a child exploitation case, and you have a case where the defendant has sent text messages to the victim. Now, cell phone companies, not all of them maintain or store those text messages, but some of them do. And say they store those text messages outside of the state. Well, under federal law, under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, states are required to have a search warrant to get access to those records. So say, for instance, you want, I don't know where all the companies are located, say they're in California and they're stored on some server in California. Federal law says, as law enforcement, we have to have a search warrant to get to those records. But under our current Oregon law, there's no process for doing that. This would allow for that process. The other thing it does is important is that it allows, when you actually issue this process to one of these businesses, is it allows them to do an affidavit or declaration that attests to the authenticity of the documents. And in that case, and you wouldn't have to call it a trial or some other hearing, have to call somebody from that business to come testify because the documents are already authenticated. Now, if there's a party, the opposing party doesn't want to do that and wants to challenge the admissibility, this has a process in the bill to allow for that, so the due process rights are protected. Now, one final point I'd like to make, too, is that this applies equally, and I hope I made it, but maybe I didn't, that it applies equally to the state and to the defense attorneys, because it's important to the criminal justice system that we get those records, regardless of whether or not they're in the state. That's my testimony. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, as I said earlier, my name is Diana Vitalens, and I'm the Crook County District Attorney, and I'm here to testify in support of Section 4 of 2502-2 amendments. Essentially, we passed a criminal forfeiture law in 2005, and as we've been using that law, we discovered a hole that I think needs to be fixed. Currently, the criminal forfeiture law allows for proceeds of forfeiture to be paid to victims as restitution if the victims are victims of a Class A misdemeanor or a person felony. And what's come up, and I can give two specific cases as example, is that there was a case in Washington County where an employee embezzled a significant amount of money from the employer, purchased a house with the proceeds of the money that she embezzled, and then turned around and tried to sell it. Well, the Washington County District Attorney's Office froze that sale and froze the proceeds, but it was a very difficult procedure in trying to get the victim money back because the criminal forfeiture statute is specific about money going back to law enforcement and treatment. And so we'd like to expand that to allow any restitution owed to any victim. Just briefly, I had a case where a woman became the victim of a theft, and he was a handsome young 75-year-old, and she was an 85-year-old woman. He rides into Prineville and sweeps her off at her feet, and then decides he's going to steal all of her money and starts doing that, and then abandons her because she has Alzheimer's. And so we basically learned of the theft as he started selling her house, cleaning out her bank accounts, and so I was able to freeze all that money using the criminal forfeiture statute. However, it took a civil litigation in order to get her money back, and so we'd like to fix this so that victims, if it's a case where restitution is appropriate, that the forfeiture proceeds could be paid to victims. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Firstly, I'd like to thank Representative Olson and the Department of Justice for bringing us to the table on this bill. We have met many, many times, and it is a very balanced bill. It does give beneficial aspects to the defendant, and we appreciate that very much. OCDLA can't really say it's opposing the bill. It has concerns about it. We are the beneficiary of some of its provisions that we have questions about, and so to that extent we would be neutral. Here's the nature of our concern. It would allow a state court judge to compel the production of property that lies beyond the state boundaries of Oregon when the person that they are compelling is outside the state of Oregon, as is the property outside the state of Oregon. And that's a big switch. What we've been doing, all 50 states ascribe to a uniform act. It's called the Uniform Act to Secure the Attendance of Witnesses from Without the State in a Criminal Proceeding. And it's cumbersome, I would agree, but it does respect state boundary lines. It compels, if a judge in Oregon wants something or some party to a criminal case wants something, the court in Oregon issues an order requesting a judge in the other foreign state to issue an order to compel that custodian of records or person into the courtroom in that other state and issue the order to that person, comply with this order and produce your records in Oregon, if that made sense. I acknowledge it's cumbersome, but we've been operating under that law, as have the other 50 states, since 1973. It is similar to the law that's present in the federal system. In federal court, if a judge in district court here in Oregon wants to issue a search warrant for property that is in Texas, the federal district court in Oregon does not issue that warrant. It requests a federal court judge in Texas, in the judicial district in Texas, to issue the warrant, or a state court judge in Texas to issue the warrant. So there's a careful acknowledgement that the judicial process of a state court judge, or even a federal court judge, is limited to its territorial boundaries. So this would change that. Now, it changes that, I acknowledge, based on the statute in Washington. The Washington statute is new. It was enacted in 2008. We've shepherdized it, meaning we've put it through a search in computer software, and there's no case law that interprets it. I cannot find a case that specifically says this is permissible, and I cannot find a case that specifically says this is not. We simply have questions. It does turn things on its head. I will note that the Washington statute does have a reciprocity provision that our statute would not, and I don't know if that would be essential to its constitutionality, but the Washington statute reads, a Washington recipient, when served with process that was issued by or in another state, that's on its face purports to be valid criminal process, shall comply with that process as if that process had been issued by a Washington court. We don't have that reciprocity provision in this bill. But it does kind of highlight, too, the reduced official nature of what it is we're asking for. Something simply merely on its face purports to be valid, and we're expecting people to comply with it. At least under the Uniform Act, you've got a judge in that other state issuing the order. I would note, too, that under the definition for recipient on page 4 of the bill, lines 9, the recipient means a business entity or a nonprofit entity. There's no requirement here that the business or transactions that that recipient engaged in Oregon is at all related to the type of record that we're seeking. So, for instance, you might have a nonprofit like United Way that conducts certain transactions here in Oregon, but we might be seeking business records of an employee who lives in Washington or Massachusetts. So there's no real nexus between the type of record requested and the type of business that the recipient conducted. Lastly, on another concern, and this is my last to be stated here, is Section 9, page 3, a recipient of criminal process is immune for complying and for any failure to provide notice of any disclosure to a person who is subject of or identified in the disclosure. Basically means someone can produce records in response to this process and not inform the account holder that it's been produced. We would like to at least to see that that failure to provide notice must otherwise be permissible under law, because in some instances you have to provide notice to the account holder. So, sure. That concludes our comments.
Gail, I guess my question is, I can imagine there may be theoretical arguments against this under the Constitution or due process. I guess my question would be, let those challenges be what they may. Shouldn't we make it as easy as we can for our court system to get this information up to the limit of constitutionality, whatever, wherever that may be determined to be? Why not authorize this? And if it's going to be challenged on federal constitutional grounds, okay. But it sounds like we don't have any kind of definitive guidance that it's unconstitutional. The Washington example suggests otherwise. So is there some other reason that we shouldn't proceed aside from the theoretical challenge that may exist to it?
Chair Barker and Representative Garrett, members of the committee, I think your point's well taken. I think it's a policy decision of respect of jurisdictional boundaries of state to state. I can't really call it comity, but it approaches that. And so I think it would give cause for pause as to whether or not Oregon's legislature would want to be careless in that respect. I will say that as a matter of practice, this does happen. A lot of times in a criminal case, if I called up a custodian of records in another state and I'll say, would you just accept a subpoena by fax? You know, would you argue with this? And they don't. So as a matter of practice, this does happen. And in response to your question, I think it might be a policy decision.
Further questions, Representative Barton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have perhaps the almost exact opposite question of Representative Garrett, the flip side of the coin, in that what is the compelling need for this bill? Is there a problem that I'm unaware of? I mean, this is based on a Uniform Act that has been adopted by every American jurisdiction since 1973. Washington has enacted a statute, which I personally agree is of dubious constitutionality in some hypothetical, admittedly extreme situations, but actually situations that I think are almost certain to arise with the passage of time. And I'm wondering why we're doing this. We have a pretty good system, both in civil and criminal matters. And why is this bill necessary?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton. I guess I'll first start addressing about the constitutionality of the statute and about the sort of minimum contacts. It's been around in federal jurisprudence for a long time that a state cannot subject somebody from out the state without having some sort of due process requirements. The big case for that is Washington versus International Shoe. And I'll just describe a brief summary of what it says. The defendant must have minimum contacts with the forum state. Minimum contacts will be found when the defendant has purposely directed his activities at residence of the forum state and where the litigation arises of or relates to those activities. Second, even if minimum contacts exist, the exercise of jurisdiction must be reasonable. In the light of various factors deemed relevant by the court, the exercise of jurisdiction must comport with fair play and substantial justice. So this law is going to be interpreted and bound by the constitutional limitations that have been in place for a long time. So, and I'll point out the other issue with this, that the limitations on jurisdiction are actually unique to the criminal law. The civil law has long had what we refer to as long-arm jurisdiction. And so you look under ORCP 4L, I actually have it here, and it says that, you have, the state of Oregon has jurisdiction, notwithstanding a failure to satisfy any other requirements of jurisdiction, in any action where the prosecution of the action against the defendant in this state is not inconsistent with the Constitution of this state or the Constitution of the United States. So in civil law, litigants have exercised or enjoyed sort of broad authority to reach out to people beyond the state. We just haven't had the same authority in criminal law, and that's what this gives us. The need for it arises is because of basically the globalization of the economy, and that we're not in a situation now where businesses are maintaining their records here in this state. I mean, if you're trying to get a record from, say, U.S. Bank, it's not here. It's going to be in South Dakota. And especially under federal law, there's a lot of limitations under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act that limits government access to records of electronic communication service providers. So that's your cell phone companies, that's your Yahoo, that's your Google. Their records are often very relevant and important in criminal investigations, especially ones involving the Internet, ones involving identity theft. And actually, identity theft is really what generated the Washington laws, just trying to get to those records. So when those records are out of state and the federal law requires some Oregon process to get those, be it subpoena, be it an order, be it a search warrant, we need some mechanism under Oregon law to get to the records.
Thank you. So just to use your civil law, for example, let's pretend it seems actually that currently, I mean, we go through, I suppose, cumbersome, but not particularly cumbersome process, similar to what is the status quo in criminal procedure now, I believe. For example, we have to issue a subpoena, then we have to register, you know, and then there's a petition to register a foreign deposition instrument, for example, then issue, say, a California subpoena when records are in California. It's not dissimilar, I believe. I'll take you, I mean, I'm no expert, certainly, on criminal procedure, but it's not dissimilar to what we have now in criminal procedure, is it? I don't understand why current rules of criminal procedure are somehow inadequate, and I'm concerned that we are creating some unintended consequences.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, in response to that question, and I'm not a civil expert, yeah, so I'd have to defer to you on that one. On the criminal law, the law we're talking about is the Uniform Act to Secure the Witness from Without a State. And there's a process in which an Oregon court judge can get a certification, send it to a foreign jurisdiction to that judge, and get them to demand that the witness come back and appear in the state of Oregon. And you can do that with subpoenas. Right, and that's what the law is for. And it is cumbersome, it's expensive, and you got to bring back the custodian. With it, this law would allow you to not have to bring back the custodian. The other two important differences are is that that law does not refer to court orders, and it does not refer to search warrants, which both under federal law are necessary to access very vital records for criminal investigations. And so we don't have any process for exercising the authority granted under federal law to get to those records.
One last, I gather perhaps, I have a number of technical questions that perhaps it might be appropriate we can discuss later or take it offline. But with that said, also, I suppose a new field that we can get into later would be this bill as drafted just talks about jurisdictions outside of Oregon. It doesn't make any distinction between domestic and international, for example. Obviously, international SHU and other due process concerns will bound that, but I just wonder if that might be necessary or appropriate in the rules or the procedure.
Mark, did anybody want to add anything?
I could keep talking, but I won't.
Okay, thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I won't suspend the rules. We can adopt it.
You want to adopt the dash?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Wissing.
I move the dash twos in the 22 House Bill 2502.
Representative Wissing moves the dash twos in House Bill 2502. Is there any further discussion? Representative Barton.
Well, just a question, Mr. Chair. Is it your intent to move this bill to the floor today?
No.
And to the extent I'm happy to support move the motion into dash two. That said, I think that further amendments might be necessary before I could support it to go to the floor. We're certainly off to learn more, but that doesn't mean I'll object to that.
Thank you. Is there any objections to dash two being adopted? Hearing none, so ordered. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2502. And Representative Martin, appreciate if you could take a few talk to people so you could.
Of course.
Open a work session on House Bill 2306.
House Bill 2306 repeals the current statute and allows Oregon residents who are filing for bankruptcy to claim federal property exemptions. I believe the Dash 2 amendment deletes the original bill and increases the homestead exemption. The Dash 2 amendments would increase it from $60,000 to $70,000. Would increase it in a range of $60,000 to $70,000. And I believe you now have a Dash 3 in front of you that increases it, I believe, from in a range of $40,000 to $50,000. We do not yet have fiscal impact statements for the amendments. We don't.
Choices, the twos or threes.
Do you
want to
hear from people
on this?
Yeah.
I think everybody's heard from us. I think we need to hear
that. Well, Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendments.
Representative Garrett moves the dash three amendments. Is there any discussion? Representative Wisnant?
I think the stakeholders have agreed to this, unless they want to come up and testify. I think that we have agreement from the stakeholders on this dash three.
Okay. Well, maybe have Keith Barnes and Jim Marquis come up and clarify where we are now. The main question is this agreeable to dash threes? Or?
Well, the proposal of 2306-2 is the one from the consumer law section of the bar. And the dash three, as I understand it, is Mr. Marquis' proposal. We were thinking that perhaps meeting in the middle is the thing to do. They have proposed $20,000 less, and so we were thinking of meeting in the middle would be one alternative to that. But we never agreed that dash three would be what would be recommended by the bar.
Okay. Mr. Marquis.
Mr. Chair, Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association speaking today on behalf of the United Financial Lobby. The United Financial Lobby has unanimously endorsed the Dash 3 amendments. I'd like not to think of them as $20,000 less, but rather $10,000 more than the current statute. It is a 20% increase. It's been 3 years since we did an increase, and home prices are down 20% from where they were.
Yep. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to convey my opinion as to the, for example, the increase in the vehicle exception from $2,150 to $3,000. That's perfectly okay. But regarding the actual homestead exception, personally, I've not yet been convinced of the need for an increase at this time. I believe there was recently an increase. That said, I'm willing to honor the spirit of compromise and support the Dash 3 amendments. But that it's just that as an honor of compromise. I personally don't feel compelled to go further than that.
Representative Wisnant.
Chair, I think I also understand that this is the same amount of money that California has.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, California has a rather complicated exemption that is somewhat different than this, but what I would say is that for most people in California, they're $50,000.
Okay. Representative Geer.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add my views. I would actually be... I would have entertained going higher, but I also understand that this is essentially a 20 to 25% increase over the current threshold amounts. That's a significant incremental step, and It's good enough for me for this session, but I think it would be worth continuing to look at. So I'll support the dash threes today.
Thank you. Further, Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, one to Mr. Markey. I hear the term United Financial Lobby occasionally in this building. Could you please identify who that is exactly?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Shields. I apologize for not being more specific about that. The United Financial Lobby is a group that includes the Oregon Bankers Association, the Credit Union League of Oregon, the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, the Oregon Mortgage Brokers Association. I guess it's called the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals, which are the mortgage brokers in the state.
Okay. Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, the first time we heard
this... Excuse me. Also, consumer finance companies are part of that, too, Mr. Cosgrove's client.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Mr. Chair, so the first time we heard this bill was January 20th. Is that correct? And then the bar came to me today and said that they were seeking support for the Dash 2s, and I just got kind of a hallway understanding of what the merits were of that, and I was hoping I might be able to ask the Chair to entertain some further discussion about what the merits of the Dash 2 are before we, because this clearly is not a compromise, at least not one that's agreed upon. So before we force this compromise down the throats of the members of the bar, I'd like to hear the merits of their proposition.
Mr. Chair, I really appreciate Representative Shields standing up for members of the bar. I'd like to see more of that.
Representative Barr, I'm sorry, Chairman Barker, Representative Shields, the original proposal was to allow debtors in bankruptcy to claim federal exemptions, and we understand that is something that likely was not going to pass. And so the only difference between the Dash 2 and the Dash 3 amendments is to change the amount that is exempt from execution by a judgment creditor for a individual. The bills are identical. They do a few things. First is both bills raise the vehicle exemption to $3,000, meaning if I had a $3,000 car free and clear and I owed a judgment to somebody, they couldn't seize my car and auction it off to satisfy the debt. The other thing that they have in common is they delete the distinction between a manufactured home or a floating home and a site-built house. And so all homes will have the same exemption, whether it was built in a factory or built by a carpenter. They're the same. The only difference between the two bills is the bar is proposing that the homestead exemption be raised to $60,000 for an individual debtor and $70,000 for a married couple, or joint debtors, I should say, of a property. Whereas the Dash 3 amendments raise those dollar amounts to $40,000 for an individual and $50,000 for joint debtors. The reason that we started out, the Representative Holvey proposed a bill that we were in support of that would have raised it to $125,000, which would have been the same as Washington and Idaho.
That sounds like a good compromise.
And so we lowered ours in the spirit of compromise down to 60 and 70, and their bill, the United Financial Lobby, is supporting 40 and 50. And so the only difference in the two bills is just the homestead exemption as I've read them, and Mr. Markey could certainly instruct me if I'm incorrect on that.
Could I ask one follow-up question?
Yes, you
can. So one piece of information that I didn't get from the bar is that the United Financial Lobby felt like they made concessions on three or four other points unrelated to the $60,000 or $70,000. Would you agree with that categorization?
There was concessions on both sides. One thing that we had talked about and tried to implement was indexing, so that these would be tied, the exemptions as a whole would be tied to the consumer price index. And also there's a little quirk in the law that my wages are exempt, debtors' wages are exempt up to 75% if they are, you know, paid from the employer or identifiable in the bank. We were proposing that any wages in the hands of a taxing authority that was going to be refunded back would also be exempt. And so I think we both made concessions. I don't know that they were wild about raising anything. I mean, I can't speak for them. exactly, but I don't know that they were in support of much of a raise on anything. So we both kind of got to the edge of where we're willing to go, and we have the dash two and the dash three. We were basically saying we're happy to split the difference as the final compromise, but I don't think we quite got there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further discussion?
If I could ask one more question, I was going to give Mr. Markey a chance to respond if he wanted to. But this is individual bankruptcies, right?
This isn't just bankruptcy. This is certainly the way that it works in bankruptcy court is the bankruptcy trustee becomes a hypothetical judgment lien creditor on the date the bankruptcy is filed. And so this is, you know, if I default on my credit cards and the credit card company sues me, what can they take from me? And also, what can the bankruptcy trustee take from me if I have to file bankruptcy? Or what needs to be paid into a Chapter 13 to protect my assets? It gets complicated, and I don't know what kind of level of explanation you want, but it's both in and out of bankruptcy.
Okay. All right, thank you. I haven't quite decided what I'll do on those amendments, but feel free to run them out.
For the dash reason, was there any further discussion? Is there any objection to the dash threes? Hearing none, so adopted. And we can move it or not?
We can't.
Okay, and we cannot move this today further. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2306.
Thank you.
Further business? Thank you.